Hi, I'm Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico.
I firmly believe that you can, if you're a Republican and you're a Donald Trump supporter, you can believe that he was legitimately elected President of the United States, and you can believe that he and his campaign did not collude with the Russians, and you can still be concerned about foreign interference in our democracy.
That was Jamie Fly, one of my guests for this week, the former foreign policy advisor to Republican Senator Marco Rubio. He and Laura Rosenberger, former national security advisor to Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign and a staffer on President Obama's National Security Council, are my guests this week. They're an unlikely bipartisan duo. They've teamed up to create the Alliance for Securing Democracy. The effort is to track Russian interference in our elections and to create a national dialogue around what should happen next. Now, of course, this is quite a week to have a conversation about that national dialogue, which is rapidly descending into partisan finger-pointing. Just around 2016, the Mueller indictment, President Trump's continued refusal in many ways to acknowledge that Russian intervention, and of course, the ongoing state of what American intelligence chiefs testified just the other day on Capitol Hill is an ongoing attack against America. Jamie joined us from Hong Kong. Laura is with me here in Washington. I've wanted to do this conversation with them for a long time, but this week seems like a particularly apt week for us to be having this discussion. We're going to talk about the Mueller indictments of 13 Russian nationals, and then looking at the remarkable debate that has ensued since those Mueller indictments over, on the one hand, are we being too hysterical about this Russian intervention? Are we really in need of looking in the mirror and talking about the American political dysfunctions more than the Russian outside intervention on the one hand? On the other hand, a growing hue and cry from people both in the Republican and Democratic Party saying, wait a minute, it's been more than a year, and President Trump not only has refused essentially to acknowledge this Russian intervention, but a sense from even his own government that he has not really responded to this in the way that almost any other president of any party would have. You had the remarkable spectacle, and we can start with that, of all of the intelligence chiefs of the U.S. government testifying before Congress. This was just a couple days before the Mueller indictments, and coming out and saying America, as Dan Coats put it, the director of national intelligence, America's under attack today. And yet all of them also confirming President Trump had never ordered them to do anything about it in specific. So Laura and Jamie, let's start in with that. Do you believe that America is under attack right now and that the U.S. government is doing enough about it?
Thanks, Susan. I do very much believe America is under attack, has been under attack, remains under attack, and that the U.S. government is not doing enough about it. But let me elaborate on a couple points there. The first is what we are seeing here in the U.S. now, what Americans have been learning about that's been happening here at least since 2014, according to the Mueller indictment, is about a toolkit, an asymmetric toolkit that Vladimir Putin has been using and deploying across the European continent actually for well over a decade, and in some ways is actually just an updated version of an old Cold War toolkit, using sort of new technology to hypercharge that. And, you know, what that means is we need a better understanding of how these tools operate, both individually and in combination, and develop the means to be able to respond. But that will require a whole of society response, government, private sector, and civil society coming together. And that's, I think, what really worries us, is that we don't see that coming together.
Jamie, do you think President Trump is being accurate when he says that we're getting it all wrong? It was Obama who screwed up the Russian response to hacking, and he's actually been very tough on Russia.
I think certainly not. I mean, I think our project starts with the premise that both parties and presidents of both parties have made mistakes vis-a-vis Russia over the last several decades. So there is some, you know, I think valid criticism of past administrations not handling the Russia challenge successfully. However, you know, the Trump administration has done a lot of positive things, I think, and headed in the right direction of trying to be more assertive. A lot of that though, has actually been forced upon them by bipartisan majorities in Congress. But on this fundamental issue of the vulnerabilities that have now been exposed, that were exploited by the Russians in 2016, will likely be exploited by them again in 2018 and 2020, could be exploited by other foreign actors in the future, there's very little sign, other than some tough talk and national security strategy from administration officials like General McMaster about the threat, there's very little sign that they're actually doing anything practically to close off these vulnerabilities. And one of our major concerns is, although you now have several bipartisan initiatives starting in Congress, pieces of legislation which have bipartisan co-sponsors, there's no indication right now that any of these pieces of the legislation even will be made a priority by the Senate or House leadership in time to make a difference prior to the midterms later this year.
Well, you know, it is a pretty striking thing that a year later we're talking about talking, in effect. And especially, I was struck, if you read the Mueller indictment, right, you know, this is a campaign that began a long time ago. It didn't begin the day that Donald Trump announced for the president. It was quite methodical and strategic. It began really in the context, actually, of 2014 and the Russian invasion of Crimea and this real rupture with the United States. And it was then, according to these charges, that this particular part of the Russian information operation began, very systematically looking to analyze and understand what you would need to do to set up a political influence campaign here in the United States.
Yeah, part of Vladimir Putin's goal is really, I mean, it is weakening our democracy. It is weakening our institutions. It is, in a broader context, weakening the liberal international order by undermining NATO, by trying to pull apart the EU, driving wedges between countries, between democracies, and driving wedges within those democracies. And so, beginning in 2014, as you said, the Mueller indictment lays out very clearly, and other researchers have documented that there was an effort to begin to lay the groundwork for this. And I think that, you know, studying our vulnerabilities was clearly a starting point for a lot of that effort.
So when you created the alliance, what was your goal for it? How much money does it cost to do something like this? And are you willing to disclose the sources of it? And then let's talk a little bit about that Hamilton 68 dashboard, which I think by far and away is the way that you've inserted this group into the public discussion, because each time there's a new controversy involving President Trump, your dashboard is cited to show how much Russian propaganda is still in the mix of our national conversation.
So I think the major goal for the alliance was to both better understand the challenges that we face, to really build up the analytic capacity to see the different pieces of this toolkit as well as how they fit together. So in addition to the work on that we're doing on the information operations, we have some research underway looking at sort of the use of financial networks, both to fund political parties and candidates across the transatlantic space, as well as finance some of these other operations. Putin's use of his cronies and illicit finance is a well known tool, and it's one that feeds into this as well. So we're looking across all the different pieces, and so that was part of the goal. And then the part of the goal was thinking, using the time that Jamie and I have outside of government to be able to think more broadly about what feels like a new form of warfare, and how do we actually begin to better understand and to counter that.
So how much does it cost, Jamie, to do all this work? And tell us about this Hamilton 68 dashboard.
Well, it's obviously, the project has grown very quickly and gotten a lot of attention. And so I'll let Laura discuss the details, but it's basically, as any major think tank project in terms of the cost, it depends on the scale and how much we want to do. And I think the challenge we have is that a key part of the reason we started with Hamilton 68 is, we've talked a lot about the legislative actions that need to be taken, what the executive branch should do, what social media companies might do to make us less vulnerable to this. But at the end of the day, the only way, and if you look at the European experiences, if you even look at what some of the tactics our allies in Asia have used in response to Chinese influence, the only way to push back is to build societal resilience at the end of the day. And part of that is transparency. That's why Hamilton 68, we hope, is helpful, just laying out there what we're seeing in one particular network on a daily basis. We'd like to apply the same methodology to the other tools that Laura talked about, cyber, financial, and just let the public be aware of the various avenues that the Russians and other authoritarian regimes might use to try to influence our democracy. And so to build out these various parts of the initiative obviously all require additional resources, and we're slowly building those out over time.
We have had sort of a case study over the last week in this fusion between the ongoing Russian influence campaign and our own American domestic politics. I'm talking, of course, about the tragic school shooting in Parkland, Florida, and the Russian messaging that quickly appeared on Twitter, documented, and something we're going to talk a lot more about. Tell me a little bit about what messages you've discovered and how it works right now.
What we've seen after a number of months monitoring this network are several things. Number one, this Russian effort is ongoing. The Mueller indictment was very helpful in terms of exposing some of the history in the run-up to the 2016 elections of these tactics, but it basically stopped at Election Day. The reality is this Russian effort has continued to this day. Every day there are Russian-linked accounts that are trying to weigh in on American politics, that are trying to push divisive narratives and pit Americans against each other. And that's what we saw in the wake of the most recent school shooting. Russian accounts that were jumping on both sides, basically egging Americans on, making everyone angrier, trying to divide us rather than bring us together in a moment of crisis. And the shooting was just the latest example of us seeing that through the network that we track. The other thing the network's shown is that they're equal opportunity in their targeting. So there's this perception, I'm a Republican, there's a perception on the right that even if the Russians maybe are weighing in, it might have been great that they were anti-Clinton or anti-Democrat. And there's certainly a lot of anti-Democratic narratives that they push through their networks. But the reality is, too, our network has shown that they'll also target Republicans. They've targeted my former boss, Marco Rubio. They've gone after Mitch McConnell, Speaker Ryan, John McCain, Jeff Flake, Bob Corker. You name it, prominent Republicans, including members of the administration, have been the subject of divisive messaging from these networks and attacks. And so that perception out there that it's just one-sided is not correct. The final piece is that there's this perception, I think, that many Americans have that they would recognize Russian propaganda if they saw it, that it would be overtly pro-Putin or pro-Kremlin or always be focused on a Russian foreign policy objective. And we see some of that messaging. We see certain messages related to Syria or Ukraine that are meant to shift American opinion on those issues. But a lot of the content and the most insidious efforts that the Russians have found is really just to get and weigh into average American domestic political debates, the sorts of things that have nothing to do with foreign policy, but that end up dividing Americans. And that's a real problem with this effort by the Russians and the potential that other foreign actors could start doing the same thing. It really ends up just dividing Americans. And it's not even apparent to Americans, as the Mueller indictment, I think, made very clear, that they're basically engaging, responding, in some cases physically taking action by going to a rally at the instruction of a foreign actor when they think they're basically communicating and working with a fellow American citizen.
So on this response to the Parkland shooting, I mean, one of the debates is, well, it's not Russian bots who are telling Americans to be in favor of gun control, or even, you know, you've seen the emergence on Twitter and other social media of attacks on some of these young students who emerge almost in real time to be talking about gun control as their response to having been, you know, participating and survivors of this horrible shooting. And you immediately saw some of the young kids being accused of, you know, being outside agitators or actors or whatever. And, you know, What would you say about this? Is it really Russians pushing a narrative on the U.S., or it seems to me that it's much more about the fusion and the amplification of messages and fights that we would be having amongst ourselves, even if Vladimir Putin had never been born?
Yeah, I think that that's right. It's basically the exploitation of our divisions, of our debates, but taking those and trying to pull the debate further to the extreme, to make the extreme position seem more prevalent, and then to inject conspiratorial narratives, again, at both sides of the spectrum, into the conversation. We saw a very similar phenomena during the height of the NFL take a knee controversy, where these networks were promoting content aimed at both sides of the debate, but also trying to take advantage of what was a real debate in American society. As you pointed out, same thing in the Parkland, in the Florida shooting. You know, it's not something that was invented by a foreign adversary, but they are absolutely exploiting these particularly emotional moments and these particularly divisive moments in order to make America seem more divided. It's the same thing we saw in some of the rallies that Jamie was talking about in the instance where we know that, you know, basically two Russian-created Facebook groups organized opposing rallies in the same location on the same date so that Americans showed up and thought that they were authentically opposing each other when really it was an outside power seeking to bring these Americans together in opposition. Now, that's not to say those Americans who showed up didn't authentically hold those views, but they were galvanized in order to stand on opposite sides of the street outside of an Islamic center, opposing each other in what made it seem like a more divided moment in America by accounts linked to Russia.
So you yourselves are now becoming a case study in the divisiveness of this particular issue and the way in which those who have defended Russia are fusing with our own political debates, which are increasingly partisan. So let me read you a quick excerpt from a piece about the Alliance for Security and Democracy, which ran in a conservative website this week called The Federalist. The Alliance for Securing Democracy runs an operation called Hamilton 68 that it claims tracks Russian bots, though it's impossible to assess the claim because of the group's methodology. The advisory council for the alliance includes Never Trump stalwarts such as Bill Kristol and David Kramer, the man Senator John McCain sent to London to pick up the discredited Russian dossier from Christopher Steele. The Hamilton 68's claim, later refuted by Twitter and Facebook, is the entire basis of Congressman Adam Schiff's theory that it was Russian bots, not real Americans, who wanted to learn about FISA abuse by the FBI. The Hamilton dashboard is also often criticized, not just in this article, for being not transparent and not making its methodology available to others. And then I just want to read quickly a tweet from Glenn Greenwald, which says essentially the same thing. And he is obviously not politically aligned with the conservative Federalists. He's on the exact opposite end of the spectrum, the far left. I think Russia is the issue where the left and the far right in America now seem to agree. So, Jamie, what do you make of this critique, that this is just some sort of a neocon conspiracy that you and Laura are foisting on us?
Well, I think when we're being attacked by the far left and the far right, that probably means we're doing something right. But more seriously, I mean, this on the right, I'll let Laura speak to what's going on the left, but on the right, this has actually been the most damaging narrative, I think, that the president himself has also advanced, not about our project, but about the arguments that those of us who are concerned about Russian interference make. If you remember, he has gone at rallies out in the heartland of West Virginia and elsewhere and said to his supporters, they want to tell you you don't exist. They want to say that you were Russians, that you were basically foreign actors were manipulating the results and that you didn't actually come out to vote for me and support me. And he's tried to use that argument to rally his base to dismiss any suggestion that we need to tackle this problem seriously. I think what the president's missing and what those on the right, like those at the Federalist, are missing is we're not making any drawing any conclusions about collusion. We're not making any statements questioning the legitimacy of Donald Trump's presidency. I firmly believe that you can, if you're a Republican and you're a Donald Trump supporter, you can believe that he was legitimately elected president of the United States, and you can believe that he and his campaign did not collude with the Russians, and you can still be concerned about foreign interference in our democracy. It's a national security threat. Our intelligence community, all the relevant agencies have repeatedly testified, including Trump's appointees who now head those agencies, about this threat. I think the Mueller indictment laid out the facts very clearly. And so those on the right who are just trying to cloud this issue and tie it to a broader debate about whether Donald Trump is our legitimate president, I think they're just trying to distract from this very real national security challenge. And that's part of the problem, honestly, that I think we and others who are highlighting these concerns face in building broader political momentum, especially in Congress, to tackle this problem.
Well, Jamie, I want to go back to you quickly on this, because it does seem among the Republicans, a year into the Trump presidency, your ability to make the argument with people you worked with closely has become less possible, not more, that they have hardened in their defense with President Trump. They've identified the party, at least on Capitol Hill, with him far more than many people expected. There has not been the significant amount of resistance to Trump, even on policy issues that they might disagree with him on. And it seems that he's had a remarkable ability up on Capitol Hill, a place you know well, to get people to shed their previously held beliefs. Why is that happening?
On many broader issues, there's a lot of support for President Trump's agenda. A lot of his domestic policy is strongly supported by Republicans in Congress, even those who opposed him and were not Trump supporters originally. I mean, I think the Russia issue is interesting because I think while conservatives outside of Washington probably don't think it's a high priority, I also don't think most of them, if we were to pass some common sense measures like some of the bipartisan bills that have been proposed, providing more money to the states, for instance, to make sure that our elections infrastructure is secure, requiring more transparency related to social media, political advertising, I don't think these are actually controversial proposals. I don't think that most conservatives are opposed to these issues if you discuss them related to the merits. If you turn it into a broader political conversation about President Trump, if you turn it into a conversation where you're trying to undermine the president, which unfortunately I think some of the Democratic rhetoric on this issue, especially on the Hill, sometimes trends in this direction, then yes, we're not going to get anything done, and we're not going to actually secure our democracy against these threats going forward. But I do think there is a way to talk about it, and you've seen individual Republicans in Congress sign on to legislation, people like Lindsey Graham, John McCain, Marco Rubio. There just needs to be more momentum built behind this to convince the Republican leadership in both houses that this is something that is worth floor time, it's worth a vote. And I think we can get to that point, hopefully, eventually.
Okay, so Laura, take us back a year ago to the founding of this Alliance for Securing Democracy. It is one of those kind of big, sweeping, classic Beltway names. So, okay, so take us back, though.
Yes.
You worked in President Obama's National Security Council.
I did. And I was a career civil servant.
Right.
And yes, in the National Security Council under President Obama.
Mm-hmm. And then you worked for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign.
As her foreign policy advisor.
Uh-huh. And so you watched this Russian intervention unfold from that particular vantage point of the campaign. And did you really get in real time what was happening?
We didn't get in real time what was happening. And part of my thinking on this issue actually goes back to my time at the Obama NSC, where I was really involved in trying to figure out the U.S. government's response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, taking Crimea, moving into eastern Ukraine, the shooting down of MH17. And to be candid, my own feeling coming out of that experience that we had both we had failed and that we had failed on two levels. There was both a policy failure, in my opinion, but also there was an intelligence failure. And that intelligence failure, I think, carried over into what we've seen, what we saw in the sort of slowness to realize what was happening in 2016. There was nobody was seeing the whole picture. Nobody could really put together the whole narrative of what was happening. And that, I think, slowed and informed the policy choices that were made. Similar during the campaign. I mean, we knew parts of it. I mean, obviously, we'd known the DNC had been hacked. It came out publicly in June that that was attributed to Russia. Obviously, we knew about the hacking of John Podesta's email. And we knew that, you know, there was some interesting dialogue about the candidates happening on RT and Sputnik and some other strange things happening on social media. But nobody really had a sense of the full entirety of the picture of what was happening in real time.
So, you know, so you're on the Obama NSC, and my sense is that some of the Russia experts inside the government, people whose job it was, that they were pushing very hard but weren't getting a receptive answer really from the people at the top who felt that, you know, President Obama, he certainly didn't like Vladimir Putin on a personal level, but he wasn't really committed to a major confrontation. He was publicly dismissing Russia as a regional power, perhaps not a great one, but, you know, the invasion of Crimea wasn't as big of a rupture as it might have been. Is that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely fair to say.
And so, Jamie, meanwhile, you are working with Senator Rubio, who actually was really quite a Russia hawk in this period of time, and you're advising him his presidential campaign. You're watching Donald Trump in the primaries, and here he is out there speaking admiringly of Vladimir Putin and talking about a whole new kind of Russian reset. And you hoped that that would be a more effective political issue for Senator Rubio than it proved to be in the campaign.
Yeah, my experience working on Russia had actually started earlier when I was in the Bush administration as a political appointee at the Defense Department and then the NSC. And I was at the White House in 2008 working on missile defense, actually, and our last-minute efforts at the end of the administration to try to establish missile defense sites in Europe, which involved a lot of delicate negotiations with the Russians. During those final months, obviously, Russia invaded Georgia, and looking back at the full span of the Bush administration, I saw some of the problems with even that administration's approach to Russia, the early attempts by President Bush to forge a working relationship with Vladimir Putin, looking into his soul, concluding arms control agreements, et cetera. And that experience, and then some later work with the Russian opposition in private capacity, people like Boris Nemtsov and others, trying to help them engage the Obama administration as it went through its reset, that really drove home for me the broader problem with our Russia policy since the end of the Cold War. And so when we started going through this during the campaign, yes, I mean, honestly, Donald Trump essentially moved the Republican voters' thinking on Russia right in front of us during the primary. Now, I don't think that's impossible to change in the future. I think a lot of that's just driven by Republican voters' respect for Donald Trump. And so if he likes Vladimir Putin and says Vladimir Putin is a good ally of the U.S., or at least has the potential to be, they'll believe that. And that's what led to those changes in views. But the thing that concerned me around the same time, I think that Laura was still in the administration, was from a congressional perspective, we were getting briefings about what the administration was seeing. And it was very apparent pretty quickly that the U.S. government, the executive branch, Congress, didn't know what to do with the little bits and pieces of information that were out there. They didn't have the full picture, the sort of Mueller assessment that we now have even just in the context of the indictment. And there wasn't even real clear sense of who's the lead on this issue, or how do you handle a politically sensitive issue that where national security concerns come in the midst of a heated election? What do you say publicly as an administration? How do you involve Congress? Do you need to wait for Congress, congressional leaders like Mitch McConnell and others, to agree that you should put out statements or issue joint statements? There are a lot of issues like that where we just ended up not handling it correctly for a variety of reasons, and it wasn't just the Obama administration's fault. I think there were also some blame that can be ascribed to leaders in Congress.
Right, you're talking about the McConnell meeting. Yeah, you're talking about the McConnell meeting where he basically told the administration, "No, I don't want to have a bipartisan statement." This was in September of 2016,
I've read the reports about that meeting. I don't have firsthand information about what Mitch McConnell's concerns were or what the information that was presented to him. But obviously, we didn't handle it correctly. The American people, I don't think, were warned clearly enough. The other thing people, which has now been reinforced by the Mueller indictment, and I had a sense of this maybe of something going wrong, is this Russian effort was very active during the Republican primary. The activity on, I had been involved in Republican presidential campaigns in the past in different capacities for basically my whole career in Washington. And just looking at the way the political debate went, even the Republican primary, especially on social media, how toxic the social media activity was and the commentary about Republican candidates, including my boss, Senator Rubio. Something struck me as very odd about that. And I'm sure some of that was indigenous and was actually real Americans expressing concern. They were supportive of Trump and didn't like other candidates. But as the Mueller indictment now shows, there's evidence that there was at least amplification, possibly injection of other Russian content, even into the Republican debates. And so I think at that point, you could already even sense that something was off about our political debates.
There's a lot of pushback right now to the idea that there is an analogy between a real-world attack, a truck bombing, and the like, versus words that Americans themselves would share. A lot of people are now saying, well, it's sort of hysterical, isn't it? That's a new theme of the discussion around this Russia intervention.
This conversation, this debate about the impact is exactly the debate the Russians want us to be having. If you look at the original intelligence community assessments about the Russian goals with their 2016 intervention, they assumed that Secretary Clinton would win, and they wanted to delegitimize her victory and raise questions after the election about whether she was the legitimate president. And so this is the game they play. I think they're very pleased with the way our debate has gone. And so I don't think we should engage in that sort of debate questioning the legitimacy of Donald Trump. I do think that as long as we continue in this partisan bickering about the issue and ignoring the very basic things, some of them I outlined earlier, that we could start to do to tackle this problem, we're going to continue to be exposed. And it's not just exposed against what we saw in 2016. That's what also is most concerning to me. If you look at the full totality of what they did, it wasn't actually, yes, there was, now we're learning more money perhaps spent than we originally thought through the Internet Research Agency.
Right, that was a budget of $1 million a month.
Yeah, that amount of money is not actually a lot. The sense I think we have is that the Russians were probing, they were trying different things, they were seeing how far they could get with some limited resources. If I were the Russians right now, there's every reason for them to come back much harder next time if they really want to have an impact, to devote more resources, to try new tactics. And that's the other thing we're not even talking about. We're still fighting about what happened in 2016, the mechanisms that were used, and we haven't closed off a lot of those vulnerabilities. But I'm sitting in Hong Kong as we record this right now. I was in Taiwan earlier this week. I can tell you the Chinese are doing all of this and much more in terms of trying to influence democracies in their immediate neighborhood. Their capabilities are much more expansive in the long run than the Russians. They've got a lot more financial resources that they can devote to this in the future. And so we as a country are not even having the conversation about tackling the vulnerabilities that were exposed in 2016, let alone discussing the future challenges, the advances in technology, the way that these tactics could be applied if you marry them up with big data and hacked information about many Americans and start doing micro-targeting of messaging. And we as a country aren't even having that conversation because we're still stuck and wallowing in this debate about how many retweets, you know, have an impact.
Wallowing is a good word, but we're taking it into real time now, even with the Parkland shooting. I know Laura wants to get in, and then I want to finish the creation story of the alliance. But Laura,
while, as you noted, many people are sitting around town and debating whether or not we think this was a success. We may be debating that, but Dan Coats, in his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, said in his view there is no doubt that Vladimir Putin believes this was a success. And so I think that that is also a really important point to keep in mind. And then Jamie's exactly right on the sort of future, the sort of future manifestations of this, and that we need to be thinking about that. But I also think it's important to remember, you know, the social media manipulation was only one part of this effort. The Mueller indictment focused on that. But that's not to say there may not be others that he has in his pocket. And we certainly know about other pieces of the activity. So the hacking of the DNC and John Podesta's email, which that information was then released in a weaponized form and then sort of used in these campaigns. We know that that at least 21 states had parts of their election systems probed by Russian hackers. According to DHS, at least some of them were penetrated, though there's no indication that anything was actually changed in this instance. But certainly they have identified what vulnerabilities may be there for next time. And so this was a multi-pronged effort that wasn't just about influencing the conversation, though that was certainly part of it. But there are other pieces of this that all sort of fit together as part of this broader campaign.
So transparency is one of the arguments that's used on all sides of debates these days. And there is the question about, well, what is this Russian propaganda that you're tracking? You know, if we're worried about Facebook's secret algorithm, haven't you just come up with another secret algorithm to supposedly prove to us that the Russians are influencing our debate?
One of the specific, just to address it head on, one of the specific questions that we get from people is, why don't you release the specific names of the accounts that you track? Well, there's some pretty practical reasons not to do that. If you release the names of the accounts, chances are they're all going to disappear and reappear under some other hat. That's actually, by the way, what we've seen happen with some of the accounts that Twitter has deleted. So there was one persona, fake persona that went by the name Jenna Abrams. It was one of the most cited accounts during the election, actually, as a what media outlets, traditional media outlets, believed to be a particularly prominent, active, conservative figure on Twitter. Turns out she doesn't exist. That account's been deleted, but has been recreated several different times under several different handles. And so, you know, there's a little bit of a whack-a-mole piece until some of the underlying vulnerabilities in the sort of in the way that Twitter allows these things to operate. We believe it's really important to expose, as Jamie said, expose the narratives that this network is trying to push. Because as we've seen historically and in the European context, sunlight is incredibly important for this.
Are all of the people monitored by Hamilton? Are you sure that those are Russian bots? Are there some American accounts as well?
So this is actually one of the biggest misunderstandings about the way that Hamilton is sometimes reported on. Not all of the accounts that we track are bots. And not all of the accounts that we track are Russian. This is a network operation. And as we know, and there's been some really good writing done on this, including an amicus brief that was recently filed by some national security officials, Russia does a lot of its work via proxies. And so many of the accounts that we see operating as part of this network may not necessarily be Russian or in Russia. It's the same thing, by the way, on the hacking networks with Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. They're two biggest hacking groups. Many of them are actually not necessarily controlled by the government directly, but sometimes sort of operate on behalf of. And so it's trying to understand that how that network operates. It is a cohesive network. It does when you see a big jump with a big push of activity around something, that's a sign that that network is working together to really push a message.
So you're trying to expose the network and not just here's a fake Russian account.
We're trying to expose what is it that this network wants to be injecting into the American debate. Because as Jamie said, this resiliency piece, this awareness raising and resiliency piece is really important. And so understanding, you know, these are the narratives that they're trying to push. This is the line they want us to be taking or that they are trying to inject, we think is really important. There are other researchers who have taken different approaches. Some of them do try and expose individual accounts. One of the most interesting things to me is that there's an alignment actually of different researchers taking different approaches, kind of all coming to the same conclusions. And to me, that's actually very validating in the research and shows that the complementary approaches all kind of reinforce very similar conclusions.
So
Jane, one other thing I'd add, Susan, is that what I think Hamilton 68 has shown as well is that some of the initial actions that the social media companies have taken in the last several months as more information about these Russian tactics have been released by congressional investigators and now by special counsel Mueller are not going far enough, mainly because in their initial response, they've targeted accounts that they clearly can tell are based on Russian territory. And I think what our network shows is that that is not enough, that the Russians obviously, as Laura said, are using proxies. They're using networks that are not necessarily based in Russia. The other aspect that related to the Mueller indictment is that the indictment shows that at least the Internet Research Agency in the run-up to 2016 actually used virtual private networks to mask the sources of some of the accounts, which also raises questions about all these numbers of accounts that both Facebook and Twitter and others have said that they've closed because, for the most part, as far as we can tell, I think they've targeted their efforts on accounts that they can clearly link back to Russia. And I think our analysis shows that this is a much broader problem than just accounts physically based in Russia.
So that's an interesting point, which is you both are saying the Mueller indictment is not the sum total of the Russian intelligence and influence operation in 2016, in your point of view?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so we're a year into this experiment in bipartisanship. There's certainly no evidence to suggest that you have succeeded in swaying President Trump in his views around Russia and what needs to be done. But, you know, what are your takeaways about this? I mean, I will say, speaking for myself, I agree, Jamie, that this is a very the backward-looking partisan finger-pointing has now reached the point where it seems like it's almost crippling or shutting down our ability to, on both sides of the issue, to think in a clear and straightforward way around the nature of this threat and what should be done about it. But I have to say I'm not surprised that an already partisan issue has become even more partisan, because that's how the politics have gone over the last year. What do both of you take away from the experience? Is bipartisanship a pipe dream in this situation with President Trump?
I'm slightly more optimistic, I guess. I mean, if you look at the last year, a year ago, the administration had said next to nothing about this problem, with the exception of President Trump's statements, basically even questioning whether there was something we need to be concerned about. We now have a series of strategy documents from them which discuss this challenge. You have senior administration officials across the board, both in the intelligence community and policymakers, who are regularly briefing Congress, talking publicly about this. Even beyond just the U.S., General McMaster has highlighted what Russia is trying to do with some of our Democratic allies in the Western Hemisphere and their upcoming elections. And so there's much more administration discussion about this than there was a year ago. And then, despite the gridlock on a lot of the legislation in Congress, there is some optimism, especially when you look at the Senate Intelligence Committee, for instance. Their bipartisan approach to this issue, I think, was essential in exposing a lot of the tactics that, you know, the Mueller indictment amplified, and really kind of forcing the social media companies to begin to take this issue seriously. Without the Senate Intelligence Committee's effort, I'm not convinced that the social media companies would have ever even been willing to admit that a lot of this activity occurred on their platforms, and that all happened just within the last several months.
I share Jamie's more optimistic take on this. I think the biggest question for me is whether things can move fast enough, whether our response can at any point begin to at least keep pace with, if not outpace, the attack that we're facing. And that is where I remain concerned. But I do think that we are seeing and have seen movement on this issue. The other thing that I think Jamie and I have both experienced is, while, as you noted, this is a very sort of inside the Beltway project in a way, we actually, especially later this year, intend to start doing a lot more outreach beyond the Beltway. And we've already done a little bit of that. And we have been struck when we address audiences outside of D.C., the two of us together, at the very positive reception that we get. I think people are really struck by having a sort of bipartisan pair in front of them. I think for some people, it's a moment of cognitive dissonance, in a sense, that sort of interrupts their expectations. I think sometimes they wait for Jamie and I to actually start debating with each other. And when they find that we, you know, obviously we have different views on things, but when we largely agree on these issues, people find it very surprising. And I think it does open up people's ears in a different way to this issue. And I think that if we can demonstrate that just in ourselves, and we also have, you know, an advisory council of former national security officials from both Republican and Democratic parties, as well as senior Europeans, who, you know, are able to use their platforms to be able to speak out on these issues. I think that there actually is more hope for at least moving the conversation in the right direction. The question is just the pace.
Well, it's a pretty optimistic note to end it on. So I'm going to ask both of you, can you really – you must not be looking at Twitter a lot these days, where the conversation, I would say, has not tended in an optimistic, we can take care of this folks direction. Have you put down your phones?
One lesson I've taken away from all of this is, or one resolution is to try to limit my use of social media. And I think, honestly, we'd be better off as a country if a lot of Americans did the same, because I think what Hamilton 68 and some of the other tools have exposed is that what you often see in your newsfeed does not always reflect reality. I mean, there may be real Americans pushing certain views, but the amplification that the Russians in particular in this case are using, I think, distorts reality in many cases. And I think if more Americans, you know, started to research the information that's put in front of them a little bit more, maybe rely a little bit more on some traditional news media, we'd be much better off in terms of starting to tackle this problem.
So the takeaway is stop tweeting, start living.
I've certainly started to ration my social media intake as well. There are a lot of positive aspects to it. But for me, you know, it's not the reality of the day I want to live in. But, you know, as I said earlier, too, you know, my optimism on this may be just because that's the only way I know how to keep working on a tough issue, is to believe we're going to be able to get somewhere on it. But I believe we have to. I don't think we have a choice.
Well, you know, they always say that Washington is a town of idealists as well as cynics. So thank you to Laura Rosenberger and to Jamie Fly, who are two idealists in a world of increasing cynicism. But I do think this was a really fascinating conversation. I know the listeners of the Global Politico will be delighted to hear your thoughts and observations. And thank you to both of you, as well as to all of them.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks for having us.